Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Today we're sharing two pieces from the Stoop Storytelling Series, a live storytelling event in Baltimore produced by Jessica Henkin and Laura Wexler. These are stories from women who faced hardship because of the color of their skin and persevered in the face of mistreatment. The first Stoop story is from Charlie Carter about her first day on a new job.
It's 1994. I am living in New York. I have just completed grad school, have a few jobs under my belt. I have this awesome rent control department on Gramercy Park. You know, like that is like a score, right? $600 a month, can you believe it? And I just landed a job with a U.S. Senate campaign. Now, as a woman in working in politics, there aren't that many who are working on the campaign side back then, and even fewer who are Black women working on the campaign side. I had turned down, the year before, I turned down a government job in the White House to pursue the excitement of campaigns, and this was the thing that was going to propel me to the next level. The world was my oyster, and I was just in love with life. So I packed up all my goods, gave up my rent control department, put a year's worth of clothes in a duffel bag, and on a cold January morning with $550 in my pocket, I boarded a train to DC into my bright future. And my friends all waved from the train station, from the train platform. It never occurred to me to turn back, not even when my 3-hour train ride to DC turned into a 7-hour ride into the Polar Express. It's the first time I ever heard the term nor'easter. By the time I arrived in D.C., there was 12 inches of snow on the ground, and Union Station was closed. But I was not deterred. I went to the payphone. I called my boss and said, "I am getting on the train. I will see you shortly." And she said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "I'm from the North. 12 inches? That's a regular Wednesday." So I got on the metro and then took a $40 cab ride out to Tyson's Corner. It's like $510 left in my pocket. The cab let me out in a strip mall where the campaign office was, and it was pretty desolate, but I wasn't deterred. So I took a deep breath, opened the door, and walked into the campaign office where I found just my boss. But she was excited to see me. She couldn't believe that I had made this trek out to Tyson's Corner on this snowy day. We laughed about the wimpiness of the federal government having the nerve to send their people home. She showed me around this office, which was going to be my home for the next 12 months. I was prepared to spend 18 hours a day, 7 days a week for the next 11 months in this place. She gave me a stack of binders at a table, and that's when I heard it. And I thought, what is that? I look around, I don't see anything, and I think, well, it must be from one of the stores next door or the wind. A few seconds pass, and then it's more urgent. That's when I noticed the mirror on the wall. You know, one of those two-way mirrors? So my boss, she excuses herself and she goes into the room. I have no idea how long she was in there. But when she came out, her face was red and splotchy and her hands were shaking. She came up to me and stood on the other side of the table. She wouldn't look at me and she said, "I'm really sorry." And I was just like, okay, what is she sorry about? She's like, I don't know what to say, but it's not going to work out. And I was like, what's not going to work out? Like, what are you talking about? And she said, the candidate says a black woman can't do this job. She went on talking, and I honestly have no idea what she said. And going through my head was, oh, snap. I just gave up my rent-controlled apartment for this. It was sort of like anger, like, this isn't, you can't do this. This is illegal. And then it was like, oh, snap, what am I going to do? Followed by sort of like, who can I complain to about this? Like, who do I go to? This isn't fair, but this is a U.S. senator. He has all the power, and I'm just starting out my career. And there are only three people who know this conversation happened. And as I'm looking at my boss and feeling completely powerless, I can see that she's having the same thoughts, and we end up in the same place. I'm undervalued because he has no idea what I can do, but has formed, speculated what's possible, and he's undermined her credibility and her experience as well. So we're standing across this table looking at each other, dealing with this really hard situation, and here's this powerful man who's hiding behind a two-way mirror. So I put my coat on, I packed my stuff up, and I went outside to call a taxi from the payphone outside because I refused to let them see my tears. I refused to let this man break me. And I waited outside in the cold and the snow and vowed that I was not gonna stay powerless. Got in the taxi, and thankfully this taxi driver knew his way around Northern Virginia, so it was only a $10 cab ride back to the metro. $500 left in my pocket, but I had my dignity intact. So that senator went on to win re-election, but it was his last time winning re-election because 6 years later, oddly, women and black women in particular abandoned him. And he lost. I finally, it took me a while to find a job, but while I was looking, I stumbled on this organization called the Women's Campaign Fund, which at the time was the oldest and largest pro-choice PAC. And what did they do? They trained women to run for public office. I volunteered there and got really involved. I became a trainer after I got a job at one of the most powerful unions in the country. Imagine my delight when one day they decided they were going to picket that very same senator outside his office. None of the members or the staff realized that they were like, it was vindication for me. And when he walked by, I was like, yeah, you deserve this. Later on, I left that union to go and run the Women's Campaign Fund, and where I've, had the privilege of really of training a whole generation of new leaders and being part of the Year of the Woman, of seeing women run for governor and women run for Senate. And most importantly, it launched this passion in me that was about electing leaders that really represented the little people, that nobody should feel powerless like I felt powerless. And there should be no leader who would strip an individual of their power, their dignity, their ability to make a living. And that has been my gift. So I reclaimed my power by living my dream, by building new leaders. And 20 years later, I find myself in Maryland. And who do I run into? That campaign manager. She reclaimed her power. She's now one of the most sought-after consultants in the country. She has the power to choose who she works for, and she only works for women candidates. So, thank you.
That was a Stoop Story from Charlie Carter, founder of Step Up Maryland, which offers training to progressive candidates for public office. We need to take a quick break here on the record. When we're back, another piece from the Stoop Storytelling series about an unfriendly welcome to a new country. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Priya Mysore spent 2 years in Cambodia serving in the Peace Corps. Although she arrived ready to make lifelong friends, the reception she received was less than welcoming. She shared this experience with the Stoop Storytelling series.
I applied to the Peace Corps when I was 20 years old. So as you can imagine, I had this very idealistic idea of what it would be like. I found out that I got in on my 21st birthday, and I could not wait. And I spent the next few months, really trying to prepare myself in every possible way. But all I could think of in my head was, it's going to be the most amazing, perfect experience ever. And my parents, who are here today, will attest to the fact that I'm a very family-oriented person. So the reason I picked Cambodia is because the volunteers in Cambodia have to live with a host family for the entire 2 years that they're there. And I couldn't wait. A second mom, a second dad. Maybe I would get a brother this time. I have a sister in my real family. I was just so excited. And I really wanted to love everybody in my village. And I couldn't wait for them to love me. But when I got there, it ended up looking a little different than I expected. I was stationed in a village called Roniam in Mienche Commune in Kampong Thom Province, which is in the middle of Cambodia, kind of far away from everything. And what happened is I got dropped off by the Peace Corps van, and my host family rushed up to me. And the first thing my host mom said is, "You're not the volunteer, right? Where's the volunteer?" And I said, "No, I'm the volunteer. I'm your new daughter. I can't wait to live with you." And she said, "No, I know what Americans look like. And you're not American. You're not an American Peace Corps volunteer." And I said, "Yes, I am. Yes, I am. And I am so excited to be your daughter. I can't wait for this experience. I can't wait for all the memories we'll share together." My host brother, I did have a brother, walked up to me and said, "Why is her skin like that? Why does she look like that?" And then before I knew it, before I could put my bags down, there was this little semicircle of people, all of our neighbors next to my host home, and they were saying, "Why is she so ugly? Why is her skin so dark? I've never seen a girl who looks like that." And I felt confused because I wanted to say, "Well, all of you look like me too. We all have the same skin tone. Why is this such a big deal?" And I realized over the first few days of me being there, is that they had seen other volunteers, and they knew that the nearest volunteers to me were both white, and they were both men. So everybody in the village thought that they had done something wrong, and that's why they got me. They thought they got me because there was something wrong with their village, and wrong with their homes, and wrong with who they were. And I felt for the first time that there was something wrong with who I was. So I think in our training, we're told that if there's ever some sort of a conflict, you're supposed to communicate and learn and use the language skills that we learned. But I didn't really have the heart to do that. All I could do was run from it So I spent every day of my first month there just sitting in my room. Thankfully, Peace Corps regulations state that every Peace Corps volunteer has to have their own room with a door that closes so that they can have privacy. So that was my sanctuary. That was how I felt safe, is I went to the health center every morning, and then before too many people could tell me how to bleach my skin or why I was too ugly to ever get a boyfriend, I would run up to my room and I would shut the door, I would lock it, and then I would just read and tell myself that this is the sort of day that I could live for 2 years, a day with minimal social interaction, a day without too many people telling me that my skin color had to mean something. So one morning, a month after living there, I woke up to the sound of my host mother banging on my locked door. I opened it and I said, "Hi, is everything okay?" And she said, "You need to come downstairs with me right now because we're doing construction on this portion of the house and you can't live here anymore." So I said, "Okay." I put my clothes into this duffel bag. I went downstairs with her, and in her bedroom that she shared with my host brother, that was also our kitchen, that was also our dining room, I noticed that there was this sheet hung up from the ceiling down to the floor surrounding a mattress on the floor. And she said, "This is your new room. This is where you're supposed to live." And I knew that this kind of broke Peace Corps regulation, but I didn't want to be a stick in the mud. So I said, "Okay." And I lived there for about 6 months. And the first few weeks of it were terrible because I felt like the one safe space I had was completely gone. I was exposed in every way because living behind a sheet meant that anybody walking down the street could walk into our house, pull the sheet open and say, "What are you doing today, Priya? Why do you look like that, Priya?" So I was terrified. I really didn't know what I was going to do. And I thought every day about leaving because I didn't think I would ever be able to survive that kind of a situation. I felt that all of my privacy had been taken away from me. My only coping mechanism had been taken away. I couldn't call my mom. I couldn't read on my own without children coming up to the sheet, pulling it back, and laughing at me. And I felt really afraid. And then weeks went by, a month went by, and then something over time slowly changed. There used to be faces that popped up, little students would pop up behind the sheet, and I used to feel so annoyed and so angry and so unsafe. And then eventually I began to look forward to those little faces popping up behind the sheet and sitting on my bed with me, asking me what it was that I was reading. Because I realized something. Children see skin color, but they don't really care about what it means. It was only the adults that told me that it had to mean something. And children were just curious. They said, "Our skin looks the same, sister. We look the same." So I started to look forward to the moments when children would come and talk to me, when students would come and talk to me. And eventually, some of the girls who were in the eighth grade, they said, "Sister Priya, we've been watching all of these videos on YouTube. We've been watching Indian women like you, and we know that all of you Indian women know how to Bollywood dance." And I really am not a very good dancer, but I was going to take anything I could get, right? So I said, "It's true. It's true. I am a very good dancer." And they said, "Well, will you teach us? Can you please teach us how to dance?" And I said, "Of course I'll teach you how to dance." So after they got back from their classes in the morning at 12 p.m. for their lunch period, I started taking this group of five or six girls in the backyard behind my host family's home. And I started teaching them how to dance. And I took one Zumba class, I think, in college. So I really tried my best to pull out all of those moves. And all the while telling myself that this was the only time in my life that people would ever want to follow my dorky dance move. So I really had to milk it for all that it was worth. And it became a daily class. And those five girls turned into 50. And just girls turned into boys, they turned into moms who said, oh, I didn't know you could dance like this. Well, that changes everything. And I made friends, and people really began to love me. And it was through that that I really got to sit down with a lot of the female students I was working with, now about 6-7 months into my service, and I said, what is it that I can do for you? I'm here because I'm supposed to be able to do something for you. How can I make your life better? And I was there as a health volunteer, so I thought they were going to tell me that I needed to teach them how to wash their hands, or I don't know. I thought I was going to do something health-related. And they said, sister, we really want to go to high school. We really want to go to high school. And I said, well, why aren't you going to high school? And they said, well, the nearest one is 30 kilometers away, and it's in a city. And we would have to bike an hour and a half to get there, and we would have to bike an hour and a half to get back. And classes end at night, so we can't bike home in the dark. And I said, why can't you bike home in the dark? Like, what are you so afraid of? And they said, well, we're afraid someone's going to rape us. We're afraid someone's going to take us away. And we're afraid we'll lose our lives. So it was after that that I thought, okay, this is something I can do. And I started meeting with the middle school director in my village, and I said, the girls need a high school. And I know that it's a really big project, and I know it seems too ambitious, but this is what I want to do because this is what they really need. And it started from there. Me and my Zumba class girls and the middle school director started walking around the village every day to try to scout out a building. Any building at all would do. Any building that could turn into a classroom. So eventually we found it. It was kind of a few paces away from the middle school and the elementary school, but it was this dilapidated community center that no one had used for, I think, 18 or 19 years. And I said, this is it. I think we can really make this work. So it was after that that I applied for funding through the small grants funded by USAID. And I filed for a human trafficking grant because my girls were afraid that they were going to be taken away. It seemed like the right way to go. And we got the funding, and I met with the local government and negotiated sending 4 teachers to our village. And at this point, I did have my own room, but the teachers came to our village, and they didn't know where they were going to live because they were moving to a random village. And in Cambodia, you have to move to where you're assigned if you're a teacher. So they had no idea where they were going to live, and that was a really big problem. And I said, well, they can live with me. The female teacher can live with me because I'm used to sharing a room, and it really doesn't bother me anymore. And that's kind of how it started. So the end to that story is that today there are 257 girls enrolled in the high school that we made in our makeshift high school. And they send me videos of them going to class, and they message me on Facebook. But the best part of all is that they send me videos of them dancing. And I still have yet to break it to them that I don't really know anything about Bollywood dancing, and I'm really a very bad dancer.
That was a Stoop story from Priya Mysore, who served in Cambodia with the Peace Corps. At the On the Record page at WYPR.org, you can get more information about the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast, as well as their show coming up at the Creative Alliance on July 25th. The theme will be Truth and Lies, an evening of stories and magic. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're with us. Hope you're loving every minute of this holiday weekend.
listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.